Koutou, you're on the panel, RNZ National, Wallace Chapman with you today. And today I'm with Mihi Narangi Forbes, a journalist, a broadcaster and a presenter for The Hui. Also Phil O'Reilly, global business leader and advocate and managing director of Iron Duke Partners. Also today we discuss Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern having cancelled one of her higher profile regular media appearances. It's been quite the talk. Not least on social media, so we discussed that both with Mihi and Phil this afternoon as well. And wool, why in Aotearoa is wool not being made more use of? We have Dr. Michelle Dickinson on that. But to this first, an interesting article appeared in The Conversation. How would digital COVID vaccine passports work and what is stopping people from faking them? Air New Zealand will begin trialling digital vaccine passports or immunity passports on routes to Australia in April and will ideally quickly check whether travellers have been vaccinated. And on that, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says we could be looking at opening the border in time, given the mass vaccination rollout. With us is Professor Dave Parry, who is a Professor of Computer Science at the Auckland University of Technology. Professor Parry, kia ora.
Kia ora.
So, look, what system will we be adopting? It will no doubt be aligned internationally with other passport systems?
That's right. So, Air New Zealand are using the IATA system, which is the International Air Travel Association, and that's probably the most widely adopted around the world. There are some other ones in different countries. South Africa's got its own one, and right. I think Morocco or someone's got one. But basically, it's the most international one.
And they would need to be incredibly secure, and that's the issue, right?
Yes, that's right. So we've already seen issues where people have actually forged negative tests, for example, on paper tests in different parts of the world. So we really need to be assured that if people are saying they've been vaccinated at a certain time and a place, that's correct. And also at the same time, that if there are any issues with the vaccination, for example, if we discover that a batch wasn't very good or something, that we can track that and notify the people involved. For travel, that we don't block everybody from Australia or whatever, only the people who happen to have received that batch.
And you'd also want digital cross-checking, wouldn't you, to make sure that every traveller has the necessary prerequisites needed to enter their destination of country. I'm just thinking on that last point. The logistics of a digital vaccine passport seem quite daunting.
Well, it's actually very similar to what already happens with things like visas. So, right. So effectively what the digital passport is doing, and it's, passports are possibly not helpful, is really it's linking on your phone or generated QR code the details of what identification you're using, so what your passport number is or whatever, and the details of the vaccine that was given. What happens when you're going to the border or whatever is that your passport will still be checked, and then looking at the vaccine app, the vaccine passport, that will say, okay, the border person has checked that I am who I say I am because the passport's me. That passport is linked to the data that's on my app, and the other data on the app is about the vaccine that I've given, and the border control people, etc., will have a list of countries and vaccine providers and things that they are happy with, and if your data corresponds to that, then they'll say, right, you've been vaccinated and we're happy with it.
Okay, well, Phil, you'd be quite you'd be anticipating this, wouldn't you, with the
opening
the borders.
On.
Bring it on, there you go. what comments or thoughts do you have?
Well, one of the tricky bits, I was actually, when I read the original stuff to prepare for this, one of the tricky bits about what was being described was you might have to turn up with your passport to get vaccinated. And I thought linking the act of vaccination with a passport could actually be quite tricky, because actually if you never want to travel, you know, you're a 90-year-old person, you're happy, blah, 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 why would you have to identify yourself in that way? So I think one of the hard bits of the system will be to say, yes, you can be vaccinated. There's some privacy issues around that. And if you seek to travel, if you want to travel, it's your choice. If you want to travel, now we're going to link it to your passport. Do you give us permission to do that? I think that process will be quite important in building commitment from those who are already a bit iffy about doing the vaccine thing. I think that will be quite an important issue for some of those communities who may be less trustful.
Dave? Oh, sorry, me.
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree with that. Yes. So they're both in Australia and New Zealand now, that we're building a vaccine registers. That's rolling out in both areas. And so the idea is that, that we'll, whatever happens, we'll need to record who you are when you're given the vaccine. Now, it doesn't have to be with a passport.
Let's bring me in.
I agree with you. I think that the two-prong approach is a really clever one. And the reason for that is, you know, last night we had a poll on Māori vaccination uptake, and 65% of Māori that we polled said that they're likely to. They do want to know that it's safe and all the rest of it. But, you know, that should be our priority, that we get people vaccinated. So any barriers to vaccination should be first and foremost. And requiring people to take a passport to be vaccinated is going to be a massive barrier. Because we've got communities in New Zealand with people who don't have passports, who can literally not even get to the testing stations, let alone update their passports. And then we have our Pacific communities who do travel a lot. And so we have to really think that through carefully.
It's a big point, Dave.
Oh, no, and that's absolutely right. And so I think it's really good to think of it in a way as those old passport vaccination books, the vaccination books that you had. It's basically making those more secure. So if you don't want to travel, you don't need to take your passport, and you probably won't anyway. What you'll probably have is another sequence where you'll go in and there'll be somebody who'll say, right, give me your permission to access the vaccine register, show me your passport, right, okay, there we are, I can put it on the app for you as a separate thing. And that might actually be where you pay for it, in fact.
Yeah, then we have the issue of distrust in the government, and that's quite large in Māori communities and other communities as well, so we have to also consider that.
There's another issue too, though. When I go to the United States, for example, the United States border guards take my fingerprints and take my photo. And normally I would object to that, of course, if I was in New Zealand. Why are you taking my photo and my fingerprints? But it's part of the privilege of crossing the US border, right? That's the rules. So my sense is the social contract that we're doing is saying, if you want to travel, then part of the social contract you have about travelling is to do these things. And if you don't want to do that, well, don't travel. And that's been the situation at the US border and increasingly other borders, fingerprints taken and photos taken for quite a while now. So I think, but it's very much the two things, to your point, it's very much the two things, one after the other. Get a vaccine, no barriers to that at all, minimum. Now, if you want to travel or if you want to do some other stuff, for example, well, if you want to do that, well, there's some things you need to do.
Just a clarification, Professor Perry, on the barriers to travel. Am I right? You would need a smartphone or a tablet then to travel?
That's the preferred way. But in fact, you can also, just like you can with boarding pass at the moment, you can actually, they're planning to be able to generate a QR code as well, so a paper code as well, that you could use instead of the smartphone. So so it's easier with a smartphone, but you can do it with a paper system as well.
All right, Professor of Computer Science here, Dave Perry, thank you very much for your time there. I'm just thinking, whenever I think of travel, whenever I discuss travel here, I'm just thinking,
what is that?
What? Actually, yes. What is that?
Travel's going to Waikanae.
What? Travel's going to Waikanae.
That's true.
What actually is that? And do we miss it? Will we actually travel when the borders open? What do you think?
Probably not to the same extent. That we have. I think, you know, my family stays home more than it ever has because we're just used to it now, and we just change things in our household to make us more comfortable. So, and lots of people, like you say, going to Waikanae or going to places around New Zealand to catch up with other people. This is a great country to travel in and to spend your money in.
Well, I think it'll be different as we start to open the border. One of the reasons is there'll be fewer airlines flying here and travel will be a lot more expensive. So it won't be the same kind of market and the same kind of people doing it as it was before. But from a business perspective, what I can assure you is that at senior levels, business is still a contact sport. You need to go and shake a hand and create a trust and understand the culture and spend time in someone's office and look around the factory and so on, so on, so on, in order to build trust. And so in talking to business colleagues, one of the things they're telling me is that whole trust piece just starts to rust away over time. You can keep a relationship going over Zoom. It's really quite hard to create one. So what I think you'll see is certainly in the business travel market at senior levels, you'll see quite a lot of this travel just to go back and create markets and to meet new people and so on. I suspect that's what's going to happen.
17 past four, the panel, NZ National. The story was front page of the New Zealand Herald today. Police accused of racism of a tactical use of pain on Māori, with police figures showing Māori are subjected to painful force at a higher rate than other offenders. The figures are from an OIA request showing Māori are subject to painful force at a higher rate, accounting for 49% of all cases. Now, the tactical use of pain to being violent or resisting offenders under control was 1,800 times in the past 5 years. Police bosses are rejecting the racism accusation, insisting that while officers often deal with violent or disturbed offenders, force is always a last resort. So with us to discuss is criminology doctoral candidate and People Against Prisons Aotearoa spokesperson Emily Rakete. Emily, tēnā koe, welcome. Emily, are you there?
Yes, hey, how's it going?
Hi, how are you?
No, I'm doing well.
So, look, the figures have sparked claims Māori are unfairly being targeted with excessive police force. How do you read these figures?
The figures are really, really clear and quite unambiguous, despite claims from the police association and the police themselves. Māori are more likely to be the victims of pain techniques in their encounters with police, and there's no other way to describe that than as racist.
Yeah, right. So they have hit back, haven't they? They've come back saying, look, this is inflammatory, it's offensive. What do you say to that?
It's true, and it's from their own data. So if they think that this is offensive, well, I agree with them on that. They're the ones who have the capacity to change this. If violence is being reflected in police statistics, then the police are the ones who need to change, not academics.
All right, want to go around the panel on this? Mihi, do you want to comment on this particular issue here?
Well, I'm not surprised. Right. You know, how many reports have I read? I mean, Māori are more likely to be apprehended, charged, convicted and not paroled. Māori are more likely to be shot and killed by police. So, yeah, I mean, there was a report maybe a couple of years ago that talked about, you know, I actually don't recall the numbers exactly, but massive inequities in terms of using pepper spray and tasers and dogs and all those kinds of things. So, yeah, I don't buy it. There is an absolute issue. The police commissioner talks about institutional racism. It's just time to fix it.
All right. You want to respond to that, Emily?
Yeah, he's absolutely right, as usual. The police commissioner has done a very good job, I think, in posing himself as a progressive alternative to the old boys club who've been running the police for several decades now. But the reality is that as soon as there was a serious national conversation about the fact that the police disproportionately use violence against Māori, they scurried back to the same lame excuses that they've always used when they're called out for this. This is a problem which has persisted for decades. They've been apologising to our communities for decades, but they have done no real work, no real achievements have been made in reducing the racist disproportionality of police violence. Mihi points to a book about the use of dogs. Māori are 13 times more likely than Pākehā to have attack dogs set on us by the police. That's shameful.
We don't know the type of techniques, do we? They haven't been released through these figures, have they?
No, the police have been very evasive about the precise nature of how pain techniques work. I had one used on me before. Basically, it involves jamming a thumb into the base of the jaw socket and ramming it in there as hard as possible, try to get someone to stop moving. It's very, very painful.
All right, so, of course, the other way to read this, Phil, I'll bring you in very soon, is that, look, given there are hundreds of thousands of incidents that police attend, mainly violent, involving substance abuse, often issues around mental health, 1,800 times in the last 5 years, they would say is not necessarily that significant?
Oh, yeah, that's a standard kind of deflection that the police will turn back on. They'll say, first of all, that there are more Māori being arrested, and second of all, they'll say that these situations require this kind of force. Well, this is only one subset, first of all the kinds of force which police use. They publish that data very helpfully for criminologists like myself annually. And we see that there are thousands of incidents like this where, again, Māori are more likely to be the victims of police violence. Second of all, it is not a neutral fact that Māori are being arrested more often than Pākehā in this country. There is a pattern of racist over-policing in which they tend to focus on our communities. As RNZ broke this morning, the police have built a national database with photographs of Māori children who have been approached by police officers and put into this database. So there's a pattern here of discrimination, and it's foolish, it's childish for the police to try to pretend that this isn't racial profiling. It's a textbook example of racial profiling.
Phil?
Well, what's the cause and what's the symptom? So I was reading very carefully the Police Association response to this. And they say, basically their response is, well, look, we're just dealing with violent criminals or violent people, the same, you know, whether you're white or Maori or whatever, and we're just going to be the same no matter who you are. Well, I mean, I don't accept that either, because the evidence is pretty clear when you look back at it that there's reasons why that's occurring in the background. Now, I'm not going to suggest that every police constable out there turns up in a blues and twos as a racist. I don't think that's true. But it's clearly there's some systems getting in the way here. I mean, for example, I was talking to Sir Mark Solomon years ago about this, with apologies to Mark. He was making the point to me that you've got middle-aged Maori women sitting in jail for offences that wouldn't even get you to court for Pakeha women of similar stuff, similar kind of offences. Well, you just can't have an excuse about that. You need to walk back and say, what's going on there that gets us to this situation? And I certainly think the police being involved in that, but it's not just the police. There's other things that are getting in the way here, like housing issues, like mental health issues, like iwi forms of justice and health. There's a whole bunch of things that get in the way. But that's always an excuse. You don't need to get into it and say, actually, it's just
about
wrong
education.
That people are getting beaten up.
It's about relationships, and it's about education, and it's about knowing our history. And you mentioned Maori women. Our female prison population, 63% of them are Maori women. You can't say that Maori women are just bad people, that there's a reason for that. So you have to go right back to when there's an incident, when 111 is called, who called it? Is it a neighbour? Is it the person who's actually at it? And then when they get there, what's the conversation that goes on? How does it spiral out of control that then you get an arrest? It's about relationships. It's about knowing the whakapapa, the background of the people that you're dealing with.
Very good. Hey, Emily, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much. Emily Rakete there, who is a spokesperson for People Against Prisons Aotearoa. It's 24 past for the panel in Z National. Phil O'Reilly and Mihi Nagani Forbes with me this afternoon. Now, I thought I'd raise this as it's received quite a bit of attention. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has cancelled one of her higher-profile regular media appearances. Writes Al Hunt for The Guardian, it has surprised some commentators and fueled criticism that she is dodging tough questions. So what of the value of the weekly media slot? Are leaders allowed to be able to pick and choose? Are they better to have a mix of interviews from news stations, talkback, student TV radio, top-rating stations, music stations like The Edge? Ardern's office said the Prime Minister would no longer do a specific weekly slot on Mike Hosking's show, who is a morning host on Newstalk ZB, but would continue to appear as and when issues arise. So around the panel, Mihi, you first. What is your take on this issue that has got social media so in a twist?
Is it social media or is it just the media who feel outraged that she's pulled out of it? Look, I've been saying for a long time that the government diary it's archaic. I don't even know when it was set. And we've moved on a long time from the 80s. We now have multiple platforms. We have, you know, news operations that are coming out of a Facebook page or, you know, you've got lots of diverse news these days and they don't get an opportunity with the Prime Minister. So I have no issue with it. I think that it's time to start spreading the government ministers and Prime Minister around.
It's a very high profile current affairs and news slot. It's news breaking. It's a news making slot.
Talk ZB, like the Herald, like Stuff, like everyone else, they have a parliamentary office and they have an opportunity to ask any question they want on a Monday and most days on the tiles. Everyone, they have an opportunity. If you've got a burning question in your organisation, give it to your gallery reporter.
Phil?
Well, of course, the counter-narrative to that is that the argument goes that she's blanking Hosking because Hosking's asked hard questions. And
comments?
You've seen that. You've seen the narrative there from Barry Soper's piece in the Herald just over the last couple of days, very hard-hitting piece, where he's suggesting that perhaps one of the reasons that the Prime Minister's doing this is she's a celebrity Prime Minister. She doesn't like the hard questions, and that's why she's actually leaving Hosking. And that feeds into a rather unhelpful arrogance narrative from the government. You know, so the Prime Minister likes being on Facebook, and it also played out, of course, with the Minister of Finance not wanting to be on Magic Talk with Peter Williams. Whatever you think of that. So this
Well, that was a very different issue, wasn't it?
Yeah,
well, exactly. But you can see
theories.
How that, you can see how that plays out, though, that they only want to talk to the people
not
that they might agree
with. Not quite
the
same, with. Though, was a magic slot with greatest
but,
respect.
No, but just come back to Barry. Barry Soper, he's probably been in the gallery for how long? I mean, he works for ZB. If he's got the, you know, if Mike Hoskins wants a series of questions asked, then Barry Soper can ask those, and he asked very hard questions.
Yeah, but as you know, me, there's a difference between asking a question of a Prime Minister in a gallery stand-up or on the tiles and a formal interview.
Absolutely
no,
Phil, because we also don't get the Prime Minister to come on our show once a week, and I would say the same. I ask hard questions too, and we'd love that opportunity, but I guess there's only one Prime Minister and there's actually literally hundreds and hundreds of outlets these days. It's time to spread it around. What about Māori journalism? What about Asian journalism? What about Indian channels and radio stations, Māori radio stations? They don't get any.
Let's take, for example, one great radio station, Tainui FM.
Great radio station.
What would they get in terms of Prime Minister access?
Well, I did get a message from Te Upoho Te Ika the other day, which is the Wellington-based radio station, saying, add us to your list because we never get anyone from the government either. So, yeah, probably nothing. And it would make sense for, you know, what we're told in Māori media is to talk to Māori ministers. But quite often Māori ministers or Māori MPs can't answer the questions that we want because even though we're Māori, we want to talk about business, we want to talk about COVID, we want to talk about all these things. So, I mean, it's a problem across the board.
Right. Okay.
But I think we need to check our privilege as the media and
I mean, still massive listenership of ZB. I mean, I was making the joke with you off air that whenever I'm doing radio, that if people say to me, I heard you on radio the other day, Phil, and it's either this show or Hoskins, you know, which tells you that these are big listenership audiences. And
but,
so the Prime Minister,
Prime Minister
gives that away,
you think your diary is full.
You think your diary is full.
You probably have no idea of what a Prime Minister will die. Why should she? Why should the Prime Minister have to go on
she
to...
She doesn't have to, and she's turned them down.
That's right.
And there's costs to that. There's media reaction to that and social media reaction to that. And that's a good thing about a democracy, that there is. But all I'm saying is you can see the narrative play out. That plays into the idea. Actually, I don't want to talk to the hard-hitting journalists. I just want to talk to the soft journalists. And that's a narrative that she needs to be a bit careful about.
Susie Ferguson's a pretty tough journalist, and so is Corinne Dan. So, I mean, I don't buy into that. There's plenty of people who are asking her tough, hard questions on the daily. I mean, I don't know what the reason is that they pulled out, but I'm just saying, as a journalist and as a broadcaster for the last 25 years, we haven't had our fair share. And actually, when the last government was on, we never got them at once. We didn't have one Prime Minister or one Minister for the whole term of the National Government other than Hekia Parata.
Really?
Over 3 years.
Just Hekia?
Just Hekia.
Right.
On education and kōhanga.
Phil?
Well, that's the government's call. I mean, as I recall, John Key didn't turn up much on this station either.
No.
I've put that straight
just
today.
Just for context, I'm quoting Guy on Espen. Morning Report only started the weekly PM interview slot around April 2014. John Key agreed to it and appeared every week except once when he wanted to check his exposure over the Panama Papers story. That no-show was one too many times for me, but it was only once.
Okay, good. No, I wasn't aware of that.
I guess the point is that, you know, Sir John Key didn't turn up on the Hui Native Affairs because it wasn't the audience that he needed to serve.
So that's the issue, right?
Yeah, perhaps.
And he gets to be criticised for that too, if you want to. I guess my point is it's the Prime Minister's right to turn up to who she wants to talk to. And if she's wearing criticism for not turning up to Mike Hoskins, good. That's good criticism. Let's understand that.
Yeah.
So it's not to say whether she's right or wrong. She's made the call. And I think the criticism of it, some of that, I think, is arguably valid. Right. And if she wants to do more on Facebook, well, I guess that's her call and she'll get votes accordingly or not.
Well, I think it's important that we've got a young, population now as well. So it's actually right for our young people. I mean, we're asking them to vote at 18, so they should have an audience.
You can make quite a cynical
them.
View about that, can't you, that she's decided that she wants to concentrate on the young because that's where the votes are, and she wants to concentrate on the social media because that's where the votes are. And that's, you could be cynical about that or not, but that may well have driven that decision.
It is 28 to 5. You're on the panel, RNZ National. It's time for headlines.